From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents, context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I live in the Castro,
Fillmore District,
Bernal Heights,
Oakland, California.
Coming up, what do you do when your college curriculum doesn't reflect your people's experience? Make your own.
You go to read things in the library that you weren't assigned, and you start saying, wait a minute, these are people who I share culture with.
Developing ethnic studies. Then we visit an exhibit displaying the poetry of post-tsunami Japan.
You know, we've just been flooded. I'm outside, I'm trying to find my children, you know, my parents, my baby.
And we'll meet a woman who just might be the 49ers' first fan.
I enjoy watching it on TV. You could get up and go have a beer or whatever you want.
It's Super Bowl time today on Cross Currents. Stay with us. San Francisco has pioneered many concepts for the country. One of them is recognizing the importance of a college education that's diverse and multicultural, reflecting the populace. And so the country's first Department of Ethnic Studies was launched at San Francisco State University in 1968. The current dean of this department is Professor Kenneth Montero. He was drawn to ethnic studies as a student of psychology at Harvard when he started noticing that much of the material didn't apply to his own experience as a black man. Neither, he said, did it apply to Latinos, Native Americans, or Asians. It was, as he calls it, white psychology. That's when he and his colleagues knew it was time for a change. Dean Montero came by our studios to talk about his beginnings in ethnic studies.
As an undergraduate and as a graduate student was the first time I met a non-white psychologist, and I happened to be privileged. I met two African Americans.
What do you mean by white psychology?
Okay, white psychology, first of all, whiteness is constructed. Most Europeans, until the last 100 or so years, didn't call themselves white. Okay, they called themselves French, or even under French, they called themselves, you know, from Normandy, or if they were from the British Empire, they might have called themselves English or Scottish or Welsh or something. They didn't call themselves white, per se. But whiteness becomes something that grows out of the German and English dominance over the racialization of Europeans. And it shapes a lot of things, including it shapes the American university. So the American university is very much a German-English university. But it's also shaping all parts of society, including what is the best literature to read. American children read New England writers and English writers more than anybody else in the world, no matter what their culture is. And they become little pilgrims and scholars of Shakespeare. Nothing wrong with it. I happen to like reading Shakespeare. But I understand him as an African-American male reading the story.
How do you go from that white-centric education that you were talking about to saying, hey, I want to read Shakespeare through my African-American eyes?
One is you find a value in the things in yourself that you were trained not to mention around white people. As you knew how to be around white people so well, you didn't bother them with the fact that when they say, everybody here believes, and you sat there and go, I'm not going to tell them again, I don't believe it. I'll just go home where everybody else believes like me. And then you start to challenge, and then you start to challenge only when it's useful, and then you start to learn, and you center yourself in yourself. So you first get that your first knowledge you already had. You had it from your family, you had it from your culture, you had it from... And then you start finding, you go to read things in the library that you weren't assigned. And you start saying, wait a minute, these are people who I share culture with who wrote this poetry. You remember that your mother and father actually played music or told stories that... And remember, my generation, my grandparents were not literate. So they wouldn't have shared books with me, but my parents shared books with me. So you start to, and then you start, and it takes a long time, you then start connecting this academic knowledge to your life. Because it's a strange thing. You start learning this academic knowledge as if it's interesting, it's kind of like me, but it's still other. And then I've got this personal sense, it's Du Bois's Warring Souls, that you've got these things in there, some things that were injected into you and told you, this is the kind of American you are. And these other things that you've got, one from your home life, and then also finding these other voices in the libraries or in the paintings or in the science that someone
kind of
didn't tell you.
An informal ethnic studies class.
Yes, you do. And then you find that there are other people doing this. So remember, I'm coming through in the 60s and the 70s, and luckily for me, this was a public debate. Every day on the television, there was a clash somewhere around issues of race and class and culture.
Do you feel, in the middle of everything that's going on with ethnic studies these days, do you feel there's an attack on your, on departments like yours?
Yes.
You feel ethnic studies as a concept is being attacked?
There's nothing. I do feel those things, but that's irrelevant. It's documented. The academy, this is primarily white academy, has been silent on the fact that a state, that's the state of Arizona, made illegal ethnic studies. The academy, the keepers of the freedom of speech and the keepers of freedom of academic freedom, the broader academy is silent, absolutely silent on modern day book burning and witch hunting intellectually. Absolutely silent. And it's not motivated. This is the part about structural inequality and power that we've had a conversation about. The motivated people, the 10% that actually think about this and say, oh, good, we're going to be racists and we're going to do this. We could actually handle them. It's the other 90% who are silent because they really don't get why, they really don't get that we have an intellectual tradition. They don't really get that we have a story independent of what they already know. They still see ethnic studies as a study of us, not our study and our story. So when they hear it, they don't hear an attack on freedom of expression, or they hear a state throwing away something that they have the right to throw away. Throw away Shakespeare and see what happens. Just one author. Just throw away one author and see what happens. And it won't just be literature people who go up in arms. And I'll be with them. I don't believe that you should be throwing away Shakespeare. Not because I happen to be one of the people who happened to enjoy reading him as a child, but because you shouldn't be outlawing thought. Ethnic studies has really been, it really is about, you'll see in my tagline on my emails for the College of Ethnic Studies, liberating minds since 1968, because that's what it's about.
Do you think today's curriculums reflect the diversity of our society? We'd like to hear your thoughts. Leave a message at 415-264-7106. That's 415-264-7106, and you might hear yourself on the air. This is Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hanat Baba. And now for some artery, cultural coverage that can sometimes tell a painful story. Since the late 1960s, San Francisco State has continued to be at the forefront of ethnic consciousness and arts. An exhibit that opens today at the university is dedicated to the Japanese art form of tanka, a 31-syllable poetry form that goes as far back as the 7th century. After the devastating earthquake and tsunami of March 2011, many Japanese survivors turned to writing tanka poetry to express their grief, anger, and hope. 32 of these poems are on display in an exhibit at San Francisco State, which I visited recently.
Mahiruma no mori agari osoi kuru o tsunami kono yo no mono to omoezu.
In broad daylight, the sea rose up and attacked. A great tsunami, unimaginable in this world. This was written by a woman named Nobuko Kato.
John Funabiki is the journalism professor who envisioned the exhibit.
She lost the house that she was actually born in 1935, so you do the math. As she started to kind of rebound from the shock of the tsunami, the first thing she wanted to do was to write a poem about her thoughts.
After the disaster, people started sending in poems to Japanese newspapers. A Japanese cultural organization then collected them and exhibited them in New York City. That's where Professor Funabiki saw them.
And I started talking to them, and I said, I'd love to bring this to San Francisco because there are so many people in the Bay Area here who were tremendously affected by the what happened in Japan. People here raised money. People here did service projects in Japan. So I knew that there would be great interest in this exhibit.
Funabiki walks me through the poems hung on the walls. The second one is also written by Nobuko Kato.
Tsunami hike.
After the tsunami has receded, the sun begins to set over the high ground where family members call out each other's names.
So you can imagine the scene that she's setting. We've just been flooded. I'm outside, I'm trying to find my children, you know, my parents, my baby.
Tanka has at least 1,400 years of history.
Japanese literature professor Midori McKeon, who's reading the Japanese in this story, explains the significance of the tanka poem. She says historically, they were a main form of entertainment and were performed in the emperor's court.
In those occasions, there's an audience headed by the highest-ranking nobleman, and the courtiers would be seated in the order of their ranks. And a poem was given to a reciter, and the reciter would read aloud to the whole audience.
From the beginning, tanka was a way to express profound inner feelings, and the form, McKeon says, reflects a uniquely Japanese style.
The Japanese people really like economy in terms of its own language, pronunciation, and maybe their way of life as well. So the shorter form, 31-syllabled shorter form, was preferred to more difficult to compose longer poems. 5-7, 5-7, 5-7, 5-7. This kind of rhythm seems to be a natural rhythm, musical rhythm for the Japanese language.
As we move through the poems, the themes change from accounts of the day of the earthquake and tsunami to expressions of grief, pain, and loss. This one by Toru Mamosi of Nagano describes the first day of first grade at an elementary school. There were reports of parents holding up pictures of their children who should have been there that day.
入学式の...
Among pupils, a low voice responds to the roll call at the entrance ceremony. The voice of a mother holding a photo of the deceased.
Some of the tanka poems express anger and suspicion at what some people felt was a foreseeable disaster, the explosion at the Fukushima nuclear plant. This tanka is by Yukiko Endo from Fukushima.
Tabitabi no...
Time and again, cover-ups of the nuclear accidents. I shall not accept that this was unimaginable.
McKeon says this sentiment reflects a common feeling in Japan post-tsunami. As we read poem after poem, they start to take on a more hopeful tone, like the heroism of that day, in this poem by Fujiko Suda from Miyagi.
From the muddy stream, he saved three children for us. A diver, with eyes wild and bloodshot, like a wandering samurai.
Part of the motivation for this exhibit, Funabiki says, is to remind Americans that the Japanese will live with the effects of the disaster for decades to come.
It's everything from building the homes, but also there's the emotional trauma because of either the tsunami and earthquake or the nuclear disaster at the power plant. So there's a lot of mourning that has to go on, and a lot of different kinds of recovery.
生きて行かねば。
Possibly the most telling of the tanka poems speaks of the Japanese resilience that people worldwide admired. This one by Toko Mihara from Fukushima.
Because I have to go on living, even on the day of the atomic explosion, I am polishing rice.
I'm sure her tears mingled with the water with which she was rinsing the rice. This, to me, this is almost like a Zen spirit. You have to concentrate on here and now, no matter what. And you have to do what you have to do now. And that's the only way to bring in the future.
The exhibit Voices from Japan is on display at San Francisco State until February 14th. Details are at kalw.org. That's also where you can see pictures of some of the poets. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba. The San Francisco 49ers are playing in the Super Bowl this weekend. You may already know that. It's their sixth visit, but their first since 1994. The media's been covering the event like crazy, just like they do every year. So we were looking for a new angle, and we found something old. Actually, someone.
My name is Martha Bailey, and I live in Noe Valley.
Mart Bailey has been a 49ers fan since 1946 when the team played its very first game. And she was there when the brand new hometown team beat the Chicago Rockets at Kezar Stadium. KALW's Resu Sussman sat down with the woman who's arguably the 49ers' most faithful fan to talk about the team then and now.
I sat down with Mart Bailey in the sunny front room of the apartment she's lived in for over 50 years. She's always impeccably made up and ready to go. She's traveled all around the world and made friends wherever she stopped. She always wears lavender outfits, but this week she's made an exception to put on some 49ers red and gold.
Yes, I always liked football. I went to all the football games in high school, so when we got a football team here in San Francisco, I naturally wanted to go see them play.
Mart was born in February of 1923. 23 years later, she was there when the 49ers took the field for their very first game.
We were not too rich in those days, so we just bought our tickets at the gate.
How much did they cost?
You know, I can't remember, but it couldn't be very much if I went to all the games. I got my money babysitting.
She says it was well worth it.
You know, to see professionals play. You know, we'd seen it on TV or heard it on the radio and all. But to actually have the team here was really thrilling. Really exciting.
And so was the team's star player.
I did fall madly in love, as everybody did, with the quarterback, who was Frankie Albert at the time. You know, he was a little go-getter.
Frankie Albert is widely considered to be one of the best left-handed quarterbacks ever. A master of legerdemain who'd pretend to hand the football off and then run the other direction with it. Mart Bailey didn't know too much more about him than what she saw on the field at Kezar. This was long before the 24-hour sports news cycle.
You know, you saw them play and you just loved watching them. And I think he was everybody's favorite. Mm-hmm. And he was short.
5'10", maybe. Compare that with the starting quarterbacks in Sunday's Super Bowl. The Niners' Colin Kaepernick is 6'4", and the Ravens' Joe Flacco is 6'6". The way the players look today is different. The media hype is incomparable. And Mart thinks that football now is a little less about the local fans and the glory they bestowed on their hometown heroes.
Well, I'm not happy about it, but, you know, business is business, and that's what it's all about now. It seems more like it's more the money, more the, you know, and it's so expensive to go to the games, and people that buy season tickets are, blows my mind.
In the new stadium opening up in Santa Clara, season tickets start at nearly $100 a game. Licensing fees to get seats cost several thousand dollars apiece, even if you were a season ticket holder at Candlestick. That's a lot of babysitting.
I can't believe the cost when you could sit and watch it, you know, at home. Mm-hmm. So it's changed a lot. It's not as much, it doesn't seem to me as much as the sport of the game, as the money part of it and all.
But Mart's still a fan. After 67 years, she says she'll always be.
I enjoy watching it on TV. You could get up and go have a beer or whatever you want, you know.
In a city of transients and newcomers, Mart Bailey and the San Francisco 49ers are both longtime natives. But while the football team is working on its third stadium, one of its first fans is staying put. In San Francisco, I'm Raisu Sussman for Cross Currents.
So what are you doing for the Super Bowl? How do you celebrate? Share your plans with us on Facebook, KALW News, and you never know, one of us at Cross Currents may just crash your party. And while you've been planning and scheming for the big game day, all week long on KALW, you've been hearing this sound.
Anyone need tickets?
Anybody selling? You got extra? Anyone selling extra tickets?
It's part of our new project, Audiograph, in which we record sounds from around the Bay, the signature sounds of our area. We asked you what it is and where in the Bay Area it's from. Ready for the answer? Here's our own Chris Hoff to tell you about it.
Ever since I was a kid, I would take Bart up to the A's game down from Fremont. And I don't know how long this dude's been there, this drummer guy, but I feel like for the last at least 5 or 6 years I've been going to games. He's always on that bridge between Bart and the Coliseum, just, you know, wailing away.
I have to make the energy for everybody because everybody's happy about the game, but once I add the beat to it, the beat goes on and it changes things like that, you dig?
So when you get out of the Oakland Coliseum BART stop, you have to, you know, walk across this really long concrete bridge that goes over this weird industrial landscape and these train tracks and this nasty, foul river. And, you know, after a while, you can start hearing the fans get going when you approach the Coliseum, and it's just, that's what going to the A's game is for me.
To Chris Hoff and Casey Miner for recording those sounds. A number of you called in and got it right, but today's winner of a Cross Currents t-shirt is Richard Mercouris. Congratulations. And we'll have a new sound for you to guess next week. In the meantime, visit our Facebook page, KALW News, to hear more from Audiograph, the Bay Area's sonic signature. And that does it for today's Cross Currents from KALW News. The team includes Julie Kane, Audrey Dilling, Panina Eilberg-Schwartz, Laura Flynn, Nina Gensler-Debs, Chris Hoff, Alex Kaminsky, Erica Mu, Mary Reese, Stephen Short, RJ Sloan, Anna Sterling, Christine Stolakis, and Adam Teitelbaum. Today's show was engineered by Seth Samuel. Casey Miner is our senior editor. Our managing editor is Martina Castro. Ben Trefney is our executive editor. Holly Kernan is our news director. And thank you, we're listener-supported radio. Before we get to our local music today, we want to tell you about a little Super Bowl bet we've made with WTMD, a radio station serving Baltimore. If the Ravens win, at the end of every Cross Currents next week, we're going to feature local bands from Baltimore. And if the Niners win, they'll feature San Francisco bands all week long during their live lunch show. We'll have to see what happens. And for those of you who couldn't care less about football, check out the Super Bowl show at El Rio in the Mission this Sunday, February 3rd. The Oakland-based electro-folk band Electrician will be there, as will be San Francisco-based musician Michael Beach.
I think you misunderstood me.
For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.
It wasn't about the money. And I think you mistook me. But I'm counting on all.